So that's what we looked at last time. And Joshua was kind of setting things in order. And as he finished off, he had just told the captains of the armies and the heads of the people and everything, saying that we're going to get over by the Jordan River. We're going to wait 3 days, and then we're going to go across the Jordan and start heading on into the Promised Land. This is what they've been waiting for all this time. So 3 more days they got to hang out and wait. So if you're there in Joshua chapter 2, we're going to start right off. We're going to pick up where we left off. Verse 1. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out 2 men from Acacia Grove. That's where they were standing. That's the area where they were. It's obviously a grove of trees that was there. To spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went, and they came to the house of a harlot named Rahab, and they lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the 2 men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid on order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road of the Jordan to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Okay, so here's the story so far. Joshua gets everybody encamped. All the children of Israel are all encamped by the River Jordan, and they're going to wait 3 days. And now it says that he goes over to these other guys, these 2 guys, and he sends them out as spies, and he sends them out secretly. Now, these events that we're reading about here in this chapter are going to take place in those 3 days that the children of Israel are waiting to go over the Jordan River. And you see something about this. Joshua has learned some lessons from Israel's history. Back in Numbers chapter 13, remember, Moses sent spies into the Promised Land to look the whole place over to find out, what was going on there. And he did it quite publicly. Everybody knew that these spies were going to go out, and everybody was waiting with bated breath for their report when they got back. Well, it didn't go so great, because those guys came back with a terrible report and were really afraid. So Joshua kind of, instead of making this a big public thing and publishing it in the newspapers and all that kind of stuff, Joshua just kind of keeps it on the down low. And he says, "Hey guys, I want you to go over there and do this." So he's learned a little bit of lessons over the years, having seen what happened with Moses. Now, there is all kinds of debate and really embarrassment that surrounds the fact that these spies end up at a prostitute's house. Some try to explain this away, and they try to say, well, she wasn't really a prostitute, that she was actually an innkeeper, and that's what she was. But really, if you go into the language just does not support that. The word that they're using there indicates that she was a harlot. She was a prostitute. There's no way around that. There's evidence that indicates that in ancient culture that would be a common practice for travelers, for pilgrims. The harlots would be in places there around the city gates and around those areas, so that travelers going through would have a place to lodge and other stuff. And so that's, that was the thing. Now there's all kinds of theories that people will try to come up with as to why that these guys would have. Why these guys would have gone to a harlot's residence, ended up with a hooker. Most of it requires us to take this passage and try to read it through the eyes of a 21st century Western Christian culture. And the fact of the matter is if we're going to try to do that from the ethics of a 21st century Western culture, we're going to find all kinds of things that are going to distress us about the way people behaved in the Old Testament. The reality is, this is just where they were and what the time frame was like at that time. This is in the process. Remember, this is God revealing himself to a fallen mankind. This is his reintroduction of himself to a fallen mankind. They're not going to have all of the perspectives and ethics even in place or in perspective the way we do. So it's best not to try to convolute this and try to, make this a little more respectable. The fact is, she was a hooker, and these guys stayed at her house. And the fact that her house was on the city wall, that would make for a reasonable explanation that the lodging was there for travelers, and it would have given them a strategic appeal. Because what they're going to do is going in to spy out the land. They're going over there to look at the walls and the fortifications. That's what Joshua told them to do. Go look at, you know, what was there, what they've got, and specifically that. So that's more than likely the chief reason why they were there, but the word doesn't say that, and so we'd have to imply that. Someone must have noticed them, though, even though they're trying to, you know, kind of blend in with the crowds and trying to hang out with the locals and all of that. Somebody obviously paid attention to them being there. And obviously the people there in Jericho had become aware of this gigantic company of people just across the Jordan River massing up and waiting to come across. So, you know, people are not idiots all the time. You know, they can put two and two together and realize, okay, here's some strangers in town. They dress, you know, kind of funny. They're different from our culture. What are they doing here? These guys are probably spies. So they get out there and tell the king about that. And then we find this other place that ends up becoming very embarrassing to respectable people, because not only is Rahab a hooker, but she lies right through her teeth to the king about the situation there. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't just stand up and say, well, I can't tell a lie, but I won't give them up or anything like that. I mean, she just, you know, she gets asked, where are these guys? Well, I don't know. You know, they left or something. And then right in the next passage, she said, but they really didn't leave. She had hidden them up on the roof. And so she told a lie. She was so determined that she was going to protect these guys that she just made up a story to throw them off. It's an incredible thing to me, though. It's really something how hard people work to try to soften this somehow and to try to make this ethically justifiable for Rahab. And, you know, it really makes me glad that God included this in here and includes Rahab in this position that she's in, because he puts Rahab right in smack center of his plan for everything. You realize that, don't you? Rahab, you know, this is not this is not who you normally think of when you think of respectable people. And yet God takes this lady here, this dear woman, and he uses her in such a way that she not only gets mentioned here and becomes, you know, a part of Israel because of this, but she becomes such an integral part of Israel that later on we find out, as we're going over the genealogy of Jesus, why, look who's there in the genealogy in Matthew. It's Rahab, the hooker, the lying hooker. And she ends up being the grandmother of King David. So, I mean, that's an amazing thing, though, how God worked that out. And then later on, James even refers to her, and he talks about her did I write it down where that is? I know it's in James anyway, but, you know, and he talks about how her faith was evidenced by the way she, what? Well, by the way she hid these guys, and in actuality, by the way she told this lie. Now, he's not trying to justify lying, but he's just pointing out that her faith in God was such that she was willing to do what she had to do at that point because she believed who God was. And James looks at that and says, that's really cool. And then in the list of the heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, well, you know, he's going over all these cool guys, and there's Moses, and there's Abraham, oh yeah, and there's Rahab the hooker, and she's in the heroes of faith. And so there's another amazing thing that I just like it. I love it that God does that. God doesn't try to clean this whole thing up and make it respectable for everybody so all the respectable people don't get embarrassed by this whole thing. He just leaves that right in there, and the word doesn't even go in there to try to justify it or straighten it out ethically or anything like that. And it's not trying to say that it's right. There's nothing in there that's trying to reinforce this as the kind of behavior that needs to go on. But at the same time, there's nothing in there that tries to make excuses for it or makes God look like as if he's embarrassed at all. In fact, he's so not embarrassed that he just keeps bringing her back up. All the other religious people would like him to stop doing that, please. You know, Rahab, Lord. And the Lord just said, yeah, isn't that cool? Isn't she great? She's this godly woman here in the midst of this whole thing. This godly hooker. So Rahab, you know, and you realize that, you know, you say this, but she's not commended for being a harlot. You know, I want to make that very clear. And she's not commended for telling lies. And that's not what she gets brought up for again and again. But, you know, those aren't the things that make her special. Anybody can do that. Anybody can be promiscuous. Anybody can tell lies, but it's her faith. It's her faith that suddenly makes her stand out in front of everybody else. It's the fact that there was something about these Israelites and their God that got through to her, that stirred her heart and made her realize there's something real about this. There's a reality to this God that I've embraced and I believe in. She believed in it so much that she puts her own life at risk in order to follow through with her belief about who these two spies are and the God that they serve. She doesn't have to be, you know, she doesn't have to be perfect to believe. And that's really the message that comes through in the Bible all the time. Nobody called us to be perfect. Jesus says be perfect, but he's saying be complete, in that all that we put our faith and trust in ends up being God, consistent with who he is. But with that, but nothing ever intimates anywhere in here that we're going to be without sin, that we're going to be sinlessly perfect. Nobody ever said Rahab had to be perfect and do everything right. But what she's commended for is the faith that she has. You don't have to be perfect to have faith, but you have to have faith, and that's what it does come down to. She does believe, and because she believes like this, well, then she is regarded as a godly woman, a good example throughout all of Israel's history. And, you know, I just think that's awesome. You remember the story about Mike Iaconelli talked about how there was a woman in his church that he considered to be a very godly woman, but she was known to, you know, let loose with a curse word now and then, or smoke cigarettes. But he was talking about how she's a very godly woman. And he was at a seminar one time and he was teaching this, you know, that this woman's a godly woman. And he saw a guy get up and a bunch of people with him, and they all left the conference thing. And so he was kind of wondering about that. And he contacted, you know, some people who could find out what that was about. And well, it turns out this guy wrote him back and said, you know, I instructed my people to leave that conference and have nothing to do with your ministry ever again. Because he said, how dare you say that a woman who smokes and curses is a godly woman? And Iaconelli pointed out, he goes, you know, it's somehow in his world, there was no place for a smoking, cursing, godly woman. And yet in God's economy, we see right here, there is certainly a place for a lying, hooking, godly woman in the example of Rahab. Not that she continues on with that, not that she lives as that, but God deals with humans, and God deals with humans even in the midst of their fallenness and their mistakes and their imperfections. It's their faith that he's looking at. It's the heart that he's desiring to capture, and that's what he does. Man, he can use any one of us. None of us has any kind of an excuse. None of us can look at ourselves and say, well, you know, I just don't do this right, or I don't have this together yet, or anything like that. God can't use me yet. Oh, yes, he can. Absolutely, he can, and he wants to. He wants to use us. And in the process of using us, in the process of leading us through his adventures, while we'll be amazed at the things that change in our lives and the way we become more and more conformed to who he is and become more in harmony with his character. If we're going to sit around and wait till we get our act together, then he'd be better off trying to use a piece of wood on the ground or something than to ever try to use us. We'll never get our act together on our own. It's when we just begin moving with him and believing in him and trusting in him, just like Rahab here, that he begins to use us. All right, so then the story goes on, verse 8. Now before they lay down, you know, going to sleep up on the roof, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who are on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by your Lord, by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. Okay, so the men answered her, our lives for yours, if none of you tell this business of ours. And it shall be when the Lord has given us this land that we'll deal kindly and truly with you. Okay, so because of the testimony of faith that she has here, because of the testimony, rather, of what God has done in Israel. You know, you got to glance down at your notes, you got to figure out what it is that you said there, and then you put it all together and remember. So let me get it back together again and explain what I really wanted to say. And that is because of what Israel experienced from God, because of what God did in her life's history, because of the way God delivered Israel and the way they were able to trust him, and they were delivered from the Egyptians and all of these things, because of the testimony that they carried of God's great work in their life, it demonstrated the reality of who God is. And that touched Rahab. That's what gets across here. And you realize that the whole land around there was worried about the Israelites. But for Rahab, it wasn't just fear. She talks about this, and she's referring to this God, but I love it that you know, she doesn't just have fear. There's a faith that's been kindled in her heart, and it's demonstrated very clearly in the fact that she starts referring to him as the Lord. She doesn't say your Lord or your God or the God of your religion. She doesn't put any kind of a barrier or a distinction between herself and them. She begins talking about the Lord, and then she makes this amazing, you know, confession, this startling confession of faith of who God is. He's the Lord of heaven above. He's the ruler of earth beneath, and that puts him in control of all things. She has exalted him in her understanding to the highest state, and she is recognizing and acknowledging that he's the one true God. I mean, I love this. I think the with the light that she had, this is an amazing statement from this woman. I mean, how long has she been around these guys? She hasn't been able to be schooled in any of the Israel's traditions or anything like that. All she knows, and it's so similar to the guy in John, the guy who was born blind. And if you remember the story, and I can't even remember exactly where it is, but in the Gospel of John, there's a man who's born blind, and the disciples are passing him on the road, and they're saying, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind like this? Immediately trying to assess blame, just like everybody wants to figure out why hurricanes hit and things like that. Is it the Republicans' fault? Is it because it's a sinful city? Why? But Jesus bypassed all that kind of blaming and all that kind of stuff, and he just says, no, it's just so that the glory of God's going to be able to be revealed here and something wonderful. And so he spits on the ground, he makes a little mud pies, puts them on a guy's eyes, and he gets healed. But it happens to be at a time when he shouldn't have been healing people. It's around the Sabbath time. And so all of a sudden the Pharisees are all upset and they're mad about this. And they're trying to get this guy to make some statement. They grit him aside secretly, and they're not excited because he's got eyesight now or anything like that. But they're trying to get something about Jesus, something they can use against Jesus. And they keep saying, who is this man? Tell us, is he a sinner? And blah, blah, blah. And this guy comes back with an amazing testimony. He says, I don't know. I don't know anything about him, but this I do know. Once I was blind, but now I can see. And of course, the Pharisees, instead of rejoicing with that, they get all mad at him and they kick him out of the synagogue and all this stuff. But you realize that what this man had there, in contrast to the Pharisees, who had just years and a lifetime of training and understanding the word, what this man had in his great ignorance about Jesus was far more than all that the Pharisees had in all their religious training. The simplistic faith, he didn't have to have a wealth of knowledge. Rahab didn't know anything apart from the stories she heard about what the Israelites did. Well, they crossed over the Red Sea somehow, and it's interesting that, you know, that startled the whole nation. It's hard for me to believe it would have been the Red Sea if it startled everybody that much and it was just a natural occurrence. Something amazing must have happened there if they went across and the whole nation's around there wigging out about it. So all she knows about the Israelites is that there's a lot of them, and they somehow were able to get across the Red Sea, and they didn't get wet, and destroyed the armies of a superpower, and they know that they were able to conquer these kings, and that's the limit of her understanding about Israel. She knows nothing about Moses at the burning bush. She knows nothing about Mount Horeb when the law was delivered, and the fire and the smoke and the voice out of heaven and the trumpets. She knows nothing about any of that stuff. All she knows is that there's a reality to this somehow that's striking her in her heart, and she believes. And I'm telling you, that's why I am just not that interested in trying to come up with all kinds of really cool analytical arguments about why Christianity is right and try to argue people into believing. We would do far better as a church to just start demonstrating the reality of Jesus' love in our everyday life than to try to come up with a formula of four spiritual laws or these kind of things that, by and large, aren't going to matter much to people. Because what really needs to happen is that a reality of who Jesus is and his great love for people needs to be demonstrated so that people can believe. It's not about getting your head filled up with facts. Rahab didn't hardly have any facts, but she had faith, and that's what mattered. That's what mattered in her life. That made all the difference in the world. And now she is acknowledging who God is and what it is that he can do. And so then she asks these guys for some assurance that her family's going to be safe, that she's going to make it through this. And here again, their faith is demonstrated through this whole thing, because there's, you know, she's not saying, you know, if you guys are able to pull this off somehow, in her mind, this is a done deal. The Israelites are coming in. Our city's ruined. And she's lived in this area. We don't know how long or anything, but you can assume this is where she's grown up. And here she is. She's in this city, this Jericho, and it's got fortified walls. That's what makes it so impressive. And boy, everybody's, you know, looking at that. There's nobody's going to get through that stronghold. And surely there had to be a certain sense of safety and satisfaction within a city that had this kind of fortification. And yet in her mind, it's not even a question. Oh, the city's going down. I know this city's going to be destroyed. This whole thing's coming to an end. You know, there are so many parallels between Rahab and the experiences we have even within our culture. Because we look at our culture and we look at the American way of life and we look at these things that we've grown up with, and in our mind, well, it can never be undone. It can never come to an end. I mean, this is America. Isn't this the kingdom of God? I mean, everything, you know, this is it. And yet we do know that there is an end coming somewhere down the line here. This is all that we know of in this world is moving towards a certain destruction. It's flowing towards that destruction. And yet in our minds, it's hard to comprehend. Well, how could this end? How could that stop? How could that happen? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. But for Rahab, it wasn't even a matter of trying to make sense out of that. It was just that knowledge that, man, this is real. This is coming to an end. I've had it with this city. This city's going to be destroyed. I'm on your side now. I want to join your team. And so make sure that everybody knows that, okay? Can you give me some kind of a token, some kind of a sign that I'm going to be all right here? And she cares about her family. More evidence of her godly nature. She cares. It's not just a matter of, hey, listen, I helped you guys out. Get me out of here. I don't care what happens to anybody else. But immediately her thoughts go to her heart. You know, her heart goes out to her family. She wants protection for them. She wants to preserve them. Again, we see the amazing influence that one believer has on the life of a whole family. A whole family is going to be safe from destruction because one person in that family believes. And I think there's great hope in that, man. We can struggle for so long wondering what's going to happen with our family and pray for them and feels like it doesn't change anything and nothing changes and they still don't believe or whatever. Doesn't matter. Hold fast. Always trust. Rahab, she was able to preserve her whole family because she believed and the Lord worked through that. And so she's asking for this. She needs some kind of a sign from them that her hope is founded properly. She believes destruction's coming. She knows, that's no question, but what she wants to know is there some sign, some means by which I can find out that I'm going to be okay, that this is going to be all right? So they answer her. Actually, she let them down. Verse 15, she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was right on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, go to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterward, you may go your way. So the men said to her, we'll be blameless in this oath of yours which you've made us to swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household into your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood will be on his own head and will be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we'll be free from your oath which you made us to swear. And then she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away and they departed. And she bound the scarlet cord in the window. Okay, so they give her a signal. She's saying, you know, give me some kind of a sign. Give me some kind of a testimony that this is going to work for me. She's let these guys down, you know, a rope down the wall of Jericho, obviously, so they can escape. It's nighttime now. And so the signal to the armies of of Israel is that this house is going to be spared because they're going to see a scarlet cord hanging out. The word literally just means a red string or a line of some kind. That she was going to have hanging outside of her window when the armies came. And she and all her family were supposed to come inside of the house and stay inside the house and not go outside. No matter what they may hear, no matter what may be going on, just stay in the house and trust that that scarlet cord is going to do what it needs to do. And they had to trust that they're going to be saved then, just because of this blood-red string that's hanging on the side of the house. And this is so similar, as you look at this and you contemplate this, is so similar to the Passover account in Exodus, that it isn't unlikely that even these guys had that in mind as they gave her this sign. It's very possible in their mind that would have been something that would have been similar, and the Israelite would have recognized and remembered what happened in Egypt, how when they put the blood of the Passover lamb around the door, that the angel of death passed over and didn't take the firstborn in that house. And so in the same kind of vein here, this makes a wonderful story. I mean, what adventure and what drama. And so here's this woman. She's going to hang this cord, and she puts her faith into action as soon as they leave. And you know, as early on as the first, you know, Clement and Irenaeus and Justin Martyr, the early church fathers in their writings immediately made the connection between this account and this story and how it became an allegory for the blood of Christ and what he does for our lives and how he rescues us and how his blood becomes that token, that sign that redeems us and preserves us from the destruction that comes. That, you know, regardless of what your eschatological views may be, everything's coming to an end. No one gets to stay here forever. Everybody's got to leave at some point. And for those who don't believe, for most of us, there's this terrible sense of dread. What is beyond this? There's got to be something beyond this life. There's something more than just this. And for those of us who believe the record of Scripture, we know that there's destruction coming to those who will not believe, who wouldn't receive this salvation. But there is salvation to those who hold to this scarlet cord, who hold to a faith that blood, the blood that Jesus Christ shed on the cross, is going to be our redemption. Do we fully understand what that means? Do we fully get what it means that he died on the cross and his blood somehow rescues us? Well, if there's somebody who fully gets it, man, you got to come talk to me, because I'd love to understand it better. But to the best of our understanding, to the best of our ability to understand, all we know is that Jesus said, trust in him. All we know is that he's the resurrection and the life, and that if we believe in him, though we were dead, yet we will live. And all we know is that the New Testament epistles reinforce over and over again that it's his blood that redeems us and rescues us from the destruction that comes. And so here we see this beautiful picture of the blood of Christ that she was trusting in. She puts her faith into action immediately. Those guys leave, and she goes running around, finds a red string, and she ties it to the window, and she waits for the siege to begin. And you think about that. Okay, so here's this lady, and she's going to get all her family into the house. Well, Rahab, what's going on? Well, you got to come. You got to come to my house, because the armies of Israel are coming. Israel, you mean that big group of people on the other side of the Jordan? They are coming for sure. You know this? Yes, spies came here, and they told me that they're coming. Oh, what are we going to do? This is it. This is the end of Jericho. We're ruined. We're going to die. No, you're not going to die. I want you to come to my house, and we're going to camp out in my house, and we're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. Why, Rahab? What have you found? What do you got? A secret trap? Some place that we can hide? You got extra reinforcements in the walls? Something that's going to protect us? Fireproof blankets we can hide under? What do you got, Rahab? Well, I got this string out here hanging out of the window. Oh, think about that for a minute. That's a mighty thin shield to hide behind when you've got armies roaring over the river and coming towards your city. What an amazing thing for her to trust in, that this little red cord hanging out the window is going to be the thing that preserves not only her, but her family as well. That's such a seemingly insignificant thing. And yet, she was putting her faith and trust in that. Or was she? Not really. She was actually probably putting her faith and trust in the character of the men who made that promise to her. That they would be men of their word. But actually, if you think that through, well, really, she couldn't have put her faith and confidence in the character of those guys, because she only got to meet them for a little while, and most of the time they were hiding on the roof. And how does she know? I mean, how does she know that they've even got the authority to pull something like this off? They tell her to hang a string out of the window so she'll let them go so they can leave. But how does she know for sure that that red string is going to make any difference to the commanders of the armies of Israel? Or what if, somebody's colorblind and doesn't even know it's a red string, even if they did get the message? So really what you have to come to the conclusion of is that her faith, her trust, wasn't in a red string and wasn't in two spies who came and told her some good news. But her trust was in the God of Israel, that he would honor her faith in him, that because she believed and acknowledged that he is God, and because she had faith in the commands that were given to her by the people who followed him, she put her trust in that God to preserve her and save her, and she followed through and put that string up there. She had to have faith in God to deliver her, to keep her safe. Okay, so verse 22. And they departed and went to the mountain, and they stayed there 3 days. You're talking about the two spies. They stayed there 3 days and until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way, but didn't find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, crossed over, and they came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands. For indeed, all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us." Okay, so they come back. The mission, you know, it's a mission accomplished kind of thing. They come back in like a couple of Navy SEALs after having done their recon mission. But, you know, from a military standpoint, this mission was a complete waste of time. I mean, when you think about all the fortifications of Jericho, you know, you think about the walls and the armies that they had in there, and you know, this is a superpower within that region, within the Canaanite people. You think about everything that they had. You got to figure they've got armies and they've got cavalry and they've got, you know, battlements up on the walls and ways to be able to stop armies from coming. What would these guys have learned after, you know, a couple of days on the roof of a hooker's house? It's not going to give you any kind of insight as to how you're going to get in there. They weren't able to look, you know, for any kind of chink in the wall or something that was going to, you know, help get the armies through. You know, they didn't find a secret passage somewhere that everybody's going to sneak through in. They didn't, you know, come up with a big wooden horse or something like that. I mean, can you imagine? These two guys happen to go to the general and explain how their mission went. You know, they report to the general saying, "We're back, sir. We did, you know, everything that we could. Okay, men, at ease. Let's give me the recon. You know, it's time to find out what you know. What did you find out while you were there in Jericho?" "Well, the hookers are friendly and they live by the wall." What's a general going to do with that? Okay, latrine duty for you two. That's it. But if, you know, if that was supposed to be a military objective, if what they were going in there to spy on was supposed to be to find out, you know, how the military was best going to be able to get in here and take out Jericho and destroy that city, well, it was a huge failure. It was a waste of time. But if the mission wasn't, if the mission wasn't from a military perspective, if it didn't have an objective like that, then we can see something different that was accomplished because of the report that they give when they come back. Because they come back saying, basically, "We own these people. You guys have to realize we've got it made, because everybody here is afraid of us right now. The fear of God has been revealed to these people. They're all afraid of us. We own these guys. We own this whole countryside. This is totally ours." And so then you see that what the real mission was for these two spies to go and see what God was up to. It wasn't so much for them to go in and try to figure out how they were going to pull this off. Their mission was to go in and see what God was up to. And that's what they found out, and they were able to bring that report back to the children of Israel, and it stirred their hearts to faith. I'm telling you, that's a tremendous principle to keep in mind. And that's what we'll leave with. Instead of, so many times in our lives, we want to send spies out. You know, we're facing some kind of big Jericho in our lives. We're facing some kind of big problem and big struggle that we're trying to get through with. And so we're trying to figure out how we're going to do it. And we sit down and we make our battle plans and we try to go in there and try to figure it out and get all the information that we can possibly get about how we're going to fight this war and how we're going to fix this problem, how we're going to take care of it. Instead of doing what we see these two spies doing, what we need to do, we need to go and start looking around and seeing where God is at work. Instead of trying to figure out how I'm going to fix this thing, how I'm going to win this battle or win this war, I need to sit back and say, "All right, let me examine this a little bit, not to see how I'm going to fix it, but let me examine this and see what God is up to." because God's already at work, and he was already at work in the land of Canaan. God had gone before him just like he said he would. And what he did was he stirred their hearts to fear, and he put the fear of God into all of the inhabitants around there. And in the process, by going in there and examining this and looking around, saying, okay, what is God up to? What is God doing here? Where is God at work? Why, man, in the process of that, then an unlikely person like Rahab gets rescued in the midst of the whole thing, and God's plans are able to work out. If they'd have gone in and tried to come up with their own battle plan of how they were going to do it, why, they'd have never gotten into the promised land. But if you go in and you look at it and try to see where God is at work already, examine the situation, begin to list off the assets, to begin to list off the areas where, well, you know, I could see God is at work here, and I can see how these things are working towards a solution in this. So God is clearly doing something already, and I just have to trust in that and believe in that and follow the flow of that instead of wrestling it out of God's hands and trying to fix it and take care of it ourselves. So it's a lesson to be learned from two spies in Jericho. So Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you that you provide it to us and you enable us to glean truth from it and apply it to our lives so many years after the fact. To be able to see pictures of you all through it, what a wonderful joy that is, to see pictures of Christ and the great story of redemption that you've had in mind all along. So we thank you for it, Lord. I just pray that you address our hearts and apply these truths to our hearts and enable us to live them out as reality in our lives. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.